This is the Friday show on KLCC. I want to let you know this show was recorded on Wednesday. I'm Rachel McDonald. Joining us is Dr. Patrick Ludke, Senior Public Health Officer with Lane County Public Health, and Brian Fox, Director of the University of Oregon's COVID-19 Monitoring and Assessment Program. Thanks to both of you for being on the Friday show.
Hello again, Rachel.
Hey, Rachel.
So, Brian Fox, let's start with you. Can you describe what the Monitoring and Assessment Program, or MAP, does?
Yeah, absolutely. The MAP program offers free COVID testing to several different populations now. We were able to scale up some historic capabilities at the U of O. We have really a world prominent genomic sequencing group. And as the pandemic started, we realized that much of the same technologies that are utilized there and expertise that's utilized there could be used to run what's now a familiar acronym, PCR tests, to provide COVID testing, something that we knew, you know, a year and a half ago, it became very clear there was not enough capacity for both in this community and across the state. So the MAP program, we worked internally with the U of O, through some philanthropic investments from community members, and then eventually with investments from the state to scale up our testing. So that's one half of it, which is having the laboratory capacity to provide testing. And that's something that really only a research university or a research hospital will have those sort of capacities. And then the other part, which I spend most of my time on, is on the collection. So we've offered free community testing available at Matthew Knight Arena or the Fort Alumni Center. Here on campus 5 days a week. And then we also have begun to transition into K-12 testing for our students across the region.
Well, let's talk about the K-12 testing. How many schools are participating at this point?
Yeah, that's a great question. The K-12 testing program, something that we've worked really closely with the Oregon Health Authority on scaling up, really on very short notice. We got the nod in August that we would need to have testing available for students in September. And so we got moving really quickly to be able to get started for the first week of classes in September. We have 100 schools, about 12 school districts, and roughly 5,200 students signed up now, and those numbers continue to grow. We're really proud of the effort. We have school districts ranging from really large school districts to very small rural school districts across Lane, Douglas, Curry, Coos, Josephine, and Jackson counties.
And these are take-home tests, right? Which do not involve sticking a swab up your nose, correct?
Yeah, these are the least invasive tests possible. These are saliva-based tests. So though I know many of us that are parents are asking our kids not to spit in other times, this is the time where we really want them to in a controlled environment. So these are saliva-based tests. They come in a really simple sealed package with a funnel attachment. So folks would bring these home. They come in instructions with Spanish and English preferably before dinner. So you need to not eat for 30 minutes, eat or drink for 30 minutes before taking a test. But perfect time is before dinner, the night before collections. Have youngsters provide a saliva sample. It doesn't take much, just a couple little drops and, you know, a minute or two of work, seal that up, put it in the provided bag, and then they bring it back and drop it off at school for us to collect.
And how were these tests developed?
You know, we worked really closely with suppliers. This is one of those pieces leveraging the capabilities of a pretty large organization. So we have very close relationships with scientific supply companies. And so we have worked with companies to design these special kits. They've got the U of O logo right on the side. We're able to order quite a bit of them and work through some of these pieces. We're using a test that was developed by Yale. Actually, we've been in really close communication with the Yale group on the test, on the process, and then how to convert that test into something that can be done in a take-home way.
And are these... Did the K through 12, the program for the K through 12 students, is that specifically a routine thing that's done on a regular basis to gather information and whether or not they're symptomatic?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So this is a part of really a multi-layered approach to keeping our youngsters in school. So part one of those layers, the one that we're providing, is a weekly screening test. So students, schools opt in, and then parents can opt their students in. And for those that are opted in, they would provide a sample once a week, whether they're feeling bad, whether they're feeling great. What we found is a lot of time folks are asymptomatic, which means that they may feel fine, but they may be carrying the COVID-19 virus. So it's important for us to have these sort of rapid turnaround tests where folks, whether they're feeling good, whether they're feeling ill, they take the test. And then we can identify if there are folks that are positive but not showing any symptoms that may unintentionally be infecting others.
And why is it important? And Dr. Ludke, I imagine you might want to weigh in on this. Why is it important to have this information for the community?
Well, you know, we look at this as one tool among many, so that if we can identify and head off infections early, then hopefully, you know, we keep our schools open, we keep our communities safer. I know certainly that's why we're doing this on our campus here in Eugene and at our other facilities around the state. But I think that's similarly true for K-12. Dr. Leitke?
Yeah, I think I would add as well, from a community standpoint, you know, much of our medical system has moved to efficient practice, and sort of like car companies and grocery stores with this just-in-time delivery and these sort of things, where you don't have supplies sitting around outdating and all that money goes to waste. So we as a clinical community, we don't have huge bandwidth to test tens of thousands of tests for any particular condition, whether it's, you know, a respiratory condition or something like E. coli or Salmonella. We have our laboratories testing a certain amount based upon historical volumes. So now we have a pandemic and you have to ramp that up. And I think many people outside of the lab world think, oh, you just flip the switch and you're done. Well, it's not that way. You have to get the supply pipeline. You have to train people. You have to have the instrumentation. And we're just very fortunate in our neck of the woods to have this genomics lab that could be repurposed, and a certain number of people who have been doing this work for a long time that could be repurposed as well. So really very helpful and very thankful.
I wanted to emphasize, you know, the partnership that the U of O and the MAP program has had with Dr. Ludke and Lane County Public Health, as well as with Oregon Health Authority. You know, we look at our facilities and our capabilities as a way to reduce the strain on our medical providers, so that we can provide asymptomatic testing, whether that's in K-12 or whether that's our community testing, which then takes the heat off of our medical providers so that they can focus on individuals who are symptomatic or individuals who are sick or have other reasons to see a medical provider.
That does raise a question that I had about the testing program. Is your program primarily for asymptomatic people, or do you do tests in other for people who do have symptoms?
Yeah, so the K-12 program could be used if a student was ill, though we would always advise if somebody is feeling symptoms that they should contact a medical provider. Our testing generally is for asymptomatic individuals. For our community testing that's located here at Matthew Knight Arena, we only accept individuals who are asymptomatic. So folks that are quarantining, folks that show symptoms, it's really most appropriate for them to go to medical providers. But if an individual doesn't have any symptoms, wants to get a test because they think they may have had an exposure, or, you know, they just want to make sure that they aren't a carrier before seeing somebody in a vulnerable population, we would encourage them to come down and use our testing service.
And Dr. Ludke, can you talk just about why, you know, testing is important in general? Because whether someone's enrolled in a regular testing program is one thing, but to be able to quickly get that information, if you are concerned or you think you may have been exposed, how does that help with Lane County Public Health specifically?
I am happy to do so. The first part I would say is we need to understand from an epidemiological standpoint where the outbreaks are occurring, where the cases are occurring, and direct resources to those appropriate areas. So, of course, oftentimes we look at those people at the highest risk, so long-term care facilities where the elderly typically might be, some other congregate settings where they're all breathing the same air, like a jail or a prison. But many of those places don't have a laboratory. And in fact, probably almost all of those places don't have a laboratory. So we need excess capacity. And we are fortunate, again, to have the university step into that space. In addition, you need to have test results in a timely manner. So before we had a ramp up of testing in this country, there were jurisdictions that the turnaround time for a lab test result was 7, 10, 14 days. And that's not actionable data. When you need to make a difference on the ground to isolate people if they are infected and they can spread the disease, or if they've been exposed and you put them in quarantine, you need the data now. And we have to have that data coming from a variety of places because we're a big county. And we also have to have opportunities for large groups of people who may have been exposed to get testing all at once. And again, the university stepping in has really made a difference in that regard.
What about rapid take-home tests? I've just read an article that said they're not really easy to get in the United States, whereas they are more available in places like Great Britain. What do you think about the idea of just being able to take a quick test in the morning if you feel like you have a sore throat or a cough?
Well, I would say that I hate to be negative. I'm generally a positive guy, but I would say buyer beware. So I would encourage people, if they're interested in this, to either talk to their medical provider. He or she can connect them to a approved test by the FDA. And can order that test, and they can get a hold of it and use it appropriately. There are many tests that people can go out on their own and buy without an order from a licensed provider. And a fair number of those tests are not very good. In fact, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, on their website, you can look up the number of COVID tests that they do not recommend use. So I would suggest people take a look at that, and again, buyer beware.
Brian Fox, do you have any comments on that? And as someone who's involved with testing for COVID-19, do you think that having more options for testing and for rapid testing at home is a good idea?
Well, I'm not a medical provider, so I think important to listen to Dr. Ludke. I can say for our testing program, we have focused on providing quick and timely results, knowing how important it is to have actionable data, as Dr. Ludke mentioned. And so our results, we guarantee that they will be back within 4 business days. However, for our K-12 program, those results are usually available within 5 to 7 hours of when the test gets to the lab. So often, you know, they're being produced the night before, collected by the schools in the morning, and then picked up by our couriers in the afternoon, and then results oftentimes that evening or the next morning. For tests that are taken here on campus, those results are often available within 24 hours. We don't guarantee that, but our lab has worked very, very hard to automate our systems, to be able to structure our collection process so that it can be done quickly. Get people in and out and get results to them very quickly. Those results, we send you a text as soon as they're available, and then you log into a really simple online platform that allows you to get those. So speed matters, but accuracy matters as well. And so we focused on providing both of those to the extent possible.
And Rachel, if I could add one more thing with regard to the home testing, if someone chooses to purchase one of those and they test themselves because, let's say, they're symptomatic with COVID-compatible symptoms and they think they might have it, and the test is positive, they should report it to their provider, or they could call public health as well. If it is one of those tests that the FDA has on its list that is recommended not to be used, we in public health will say, let's confirm that test, typically with a PCR test, and we will send them to a site that's doing that testing. If it's one of those tests that was ordered by a provider, they had it at home for a few weeks until they got symptomatic, and it's one of the FDA-approved tests, we will accept that result as a positive and proceed down the route of infection control and isolation.
You're listening to The Friday Show on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald. We're with Brian Fox, director of the U of O's COVID-19 Monitoring and Assessment Program, and Dr. Patrick Ludke with Lane County Public Health. And wanted to just ask one more thing about the K-12 testing program, because I understand it is an opt-in program where it's up to the district whether to participate, and then it's up to individual families whether to volunteer to be part of the program. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Thanks, Rachel.
Is there any push to make it something that everyone is kind of already in and they would have to opt out? Is that something that the state would need to be involved with?
Yeah, that's really a question for the Oregon Health Authority. So we're a lab working under an Oregon Health Authority program. So those sort of scope questions are ones that they would need to work with. What I can say is that we have seen really remarkably strong participation from school districts in the Lane County area, and that's true across southwestern Oregon, kind of our zone of the state where we're working. And you know, each parent and each family has an opportunity to be a part of it if they wish. We certainly encourage them to be a part of the program, and we think it's important and useful information. We see some schools with really high participation rates, other schools with lower participation rates. You know, and we're really thankful for the schools who are taking on one more piece of work to help make it safe and functional and keep students in classes. We know that they're stretched very thin dealing with what's a unique school year, but we are glad to be one part of the tool chest for them.
Well, let's go ahead and get to some listener questions from our email inbox. Dr. Lidke, this one's for you. This is from Marilyn, who says, I'm 71, fully vaccinated, and will get my Pfizer booster in November. My son is not vaccinated. Is it a high-risk situation for me to visit indoors with him without a mask on?
Well, age puts her at risk. So we know there's increasing risk of severe disease beyond about age 65. She's 71 years old, so she is indeed at risk. It sounds like, because she's up for her booster, that she's gotten her first either two doses of Pfizer, Moderna, or, you know, one.
It's Pfizer.
It's Pfizer, yeah. So she's gotten her two doses. And that, of course, is really, really helpful. But there are breakthrough infections. And I wouldn't say she's at high risk, but I would say she's at risk. And because she is in her 70s, I would be careful with someone visiting who is unvaccinated. Certainly, if they have any COVID-compatible symptoms, I would visit via phone or virtually, you know, through the computer on a Zoom or something, until those symptoms have abated and they have no fever for at least 24 hours, then the risk has dropped. But yes, you're at some risk.
Well, here's another email, and this is a longer one regarding a family in which, here, I'll just read it to you. My husband had COVID-19 and isolated, separate from myself and two young children. Both she and her husband are vaccinated. A few days after he was confirmed positive, her son tested positive. And here's what she says is frustrating her. Is she says, why is he able to return to school after his isolation, but my unvaccinated daughter, who's too young to be vaccinated, has to quarantine? What's the difference? We're all together as a family again, and he and my husband, who both had it, are able to go be free, but my daughter has to continue to be quarantined.
So that is a tough question, because each one of these scenarios is a little bit different. From what I know, parents fully vaccinated, son became positive after the husband was positive with COVID,
yeah,
and the daughter not. And we allow, depending upon the environment, so let's say schools, some places of work, not healthcare, we allow people to return to work after their isolation period and their afebrile for at least 24 hours. So it may have been that this child, this boy, met the criteria one way or another. I'm assuming returning to life meant return to school. It doesn't say that specifically, does it, Rachel?
I think that was my... Yeah, he did go back to school.
Yeah. And so school, we have another set of criteria. And partly because we still have mask wearing and we still have, you know, at least 3 feet in classrooms separation, with some increasing infection control measures that don't take place outside of school, which it doesn't sound like the daughter is in. So that's probably not an answer that will be comforting to the person who wrote the email. But suffice it to say, there are different levels of risk across different environments, and we have different rules across different environments. And the child in school has one set of infection control measures, and the child out in the ambient world has a different one. And, you know, we apologize for that, but the pandemic has made things pretty complicated.
All right. Well, here's another question from someone who it was writing in response to a previous question about how long a contact with people do we have to worry about exposure? And the answer was up to 15 minutes of close contact with a positive person is considered safe. But this emailer says a cough or sneeze takes only 1 second and masks are often thin, badly fitted, or worn off the nose. According to the CDC, vaccinated people may also spread COVID-19. So they want a more full explanation of why 15 minutes of close contact is considered safe.
Well, the key point to note here is while we do not know the infectious dose of COVID, of this particular coronavirus, we know that it is not one viral particle. So your passive exposures that last, a couple seconds in the hallway, etc., unless someone has directly sneezed into your face and, consequently perhaps spread a fair number of respiratory droplets, your risk is really, really low because you need more than one viral particle inhaled to get you sick. And the infectious dose across organisms varies a lot. Norovirus, the what we used to call one of the cruise ship viruses, 10 particles and you can get that GI illness. Salmonella, which, sometimes contaminates our food, especially chicken is where we see salmonella infections pretty commonly. You might need 100,000 salmonella bacteria ingested before you get a salmonella infection. So the infectious dose varies a huge amount. The infectious dose for coronavirus is probably in the hundreds. It might be close to 1,000. So a short-term exposure, just sitting in the room together with someone for, 2, 3, 5 minutes, is very unlikely to cause you to get infected. So that's the key point really to note.
Well, thank you. And we've just got about a minute left. And Dr. Ludke, I know you have some updates about the booster clinics that Lane County Public Health is offering.
Yes, indeed. So on a prior show, we mentioned that we were working actively to get contracting and liability and such done. So we have other options for these MassVax clinics for boosters. And we're happy to announce today that we have a site across the river at the Peace Health River Bend Hospital Annex. And it will open on Tuesday for those booster doses. And I will remind people that we really want people 65 and older to get their booster dose. And people who are 50 to 64 who have certain comorbid conditions, they have lung disease, heart disease, they might have cancer, they're at higher risk. We want them to get their booster doses too. So especially those people, head over to the Peace Health River Bend Annex starting next week, Tuesday. It's open Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday from 10 to 3. It'll be open Friday from 10 to 6. And then Saturdays as well from 10 to 3.
Thank you. That wraps up the Friday show on KLCC. Thank you to Brian Fox and Patrick Ludke for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Brian Fox is the director of the U of O's COVID-19 Monitoring and Assessment Program. Dr. Patrick Ludke is Senior Public Health Officer with Lane County. I'm Rachel McDonald. This show was recorded on Wednesday, and you can listen back to this show and other Friday shows at our website, klcc.org.